I'm going to introduce now Monica Steinberg. She is a PhD candidate at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and she specializes in contemporary art, humor, and parafiction. I think parafiction is one of the main themes of your paper today. Her dissertation entitled Finnish Fetish, Art, Artists, and Alter Egos in 1960s Los Angeles demonstrates the role that humor, irony, and character performance played in determining the course of artistic development in post-war Southern California. Her research has been supported by the Archives of American Art and Smithsonian Institution, the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Research Center, and the Amon Carter Museum, among other institutions. She has also written on contemporary art in Azerbaijan, and today she will present Erasure and Reconstruction, From Judy Jerovitz to Judy Chicago.
Thank you. And thank you for inviting me here. In October 1970, this full-page ad appeared in Art Forum. It read, Judy Jerovitz hereby divests herself of all names imposed upon her through male social dominance and freely chooses her own name, Judy Chicago. Judy Chicago Jerovitz is crossed out. One woman show at Cal State Fullerton, October 23 through November 25. The ad was sponsored by the Jack Glenn Gallery in Southern Los Angeles and formally introduced readers to the constructed identity of Judy Chicago. The ad featured a photo printed twice, one a mirror of the other. The images featured the artist's butch look with shorn hair, a bandana, dark sunglasses, and a tough expression. In the upper register of the announcement, Judy Chicago handwrote a brief narrative recounting the acquisition of her assimilated namesake. In the lower section, she crossed out her former identity, again by hand, and replaced it with Chicago. Simultaneously, the ad publicized a forthcoming exhibition on view at Cal State College Fullerton, now California State University. The solo exhibition showcased the artist's mostly Finnish fetish sculptural and painted works constructed when she was working under the name Judy Jerovitz. The show included the artist's series of highly reflective and horizontally situated domes of 1968, the vertically hanging lifesavers of 1969, and documentary photographs of various atmospheres of 69. Environmental works featuring colored smoke billowing from specially designed fireworks. Within the exhibition, viewers were presented with highly finished objects that glittered beneath the gallery lights. Simultaneously, patrons were reflected within the mirrored and iridescently colored and or highly reflective surfaces of the works. The artist's designed catalog accompanying the exhibition dictated that the artworks on view were to be understood within the framework of an emergent feminist discourse. Reprinted on the cover of the catalog was the full-page photograph used in the Art Forum advertisement. The reproduction of the enlarged portrait emphasized the angled nature of the artist's posture, the turn of her head over her left shoulder, and the artist's look of both confidence and easy coolness. The portrait of the artist conveyed both aloofness and surety, and the photograph was preliminary to a catalog text filled with quotes from prominent female writers. French feminist Simone de Beauvoir, the African-American abolitionist Sojourner Truth, and the English novelist George Eliot, two of the women quoted in the catalog had also changed their names from Isabella Bomfrey to Sojourner Truth, and from Mary Ann Evans to George Eliot. The exhibition was the first to frame the artist's work within an explicitly feminist context. The publicized crossing out and replacing of an identity rebranded the works made by Judy Jerovitz when she was working in the thick of the Los Angeles Finnish fetish Milu, and resituated the artworks within the oeuvre of Judy Chicago. Finnish fetish is also known as the LA look, the cool school, LA minimalism, and a number of other names. It is often understood as the West Coast counterpart to the reductive and systematic character of New York minimalism. Finnish fetish was unique for its clean lines, surface perfection, and sensuous optical effects. Jerovitz's domes, Craig Kaufman's Untitled Wall Relief, and Billy Al Bingston's Haunted Gold are notable for the use of new plastic and acrylic technologies that emerged in Los Angeles in the post-war era. Great emphasis was placed on the work's obsession with surface perfection, its finish, achieved through laborious means that removed the facture, the evidence of the handworked nature of the objects. Gerowitz and Kaufman experimented with vacuum molded plastic forms, which they spray painted on the reverse side using an automotive spray gun. And you can see here Judy Chicago posing with her spray gun. Bingston applied automotive spray paint techniques and materials used in motorcycle customizing to the construction of his work. He carefully built up as many as 100 layers of lacquer on masonite or aluminum, which were polished and rubbed out to create dazzling and colored optical effects. These artists' meticulous erasure of labor produced the illusion of casual mastery and easy glamour that resulted from highly technical expertise. Simultaneously, these artists developed various pseudonyms and alter egos under which they worked. Craig Kaufman had sporadically worked under the pseudonym of Maurice Sindel since 1954. You can see here a business card for Sindel's studio, a space which Kaufman helped found and which operated under the fake name. Billy Al Bingston had developed multiple and ironic personas. These wavered between a country bumpkin, which was solidified in his 1968 authorized biography, which was a fake biography, and it named him a sarcastic soothsayer and the wonder kid of Dodge City Dada, and a macho biker, an identity publicized within the ad spaces of Art Forum. Within the ad, he handwrote a public invitation on the left and right, which dared readers to test his celebrity status. It reads, "If you're in the LA Basin, ask anyone about Billy Al Bingston. Happy trails, Bab." Larry Bell, best known for his glass cubes, cultivated the pseudo-intellectual ego of Dr. Lux. Here, illustrated on the back of his business card is the artist and Dr. Lux on the top, and on the front of the business card proclaiming, "Dr. Lux, good decisions day or night." Ed Ruscha worked as Eddie Russia on the left. Joe Good worked under the pseudonym Jose Bueno on the right, and the list goes on and on and on. And all of this was happening in the shadow of Hollywood's character-producing machine, manufacturing the identities of Marilyn Monroe, Norma Jean Baker, Mickey Rooney, real name Joseph Ewell, etc. Thus, rather than examining the artist's early work from the traditional perspective of biography or as a slow progression toward a feminist artistic practice, as has been done many times over, I will situate it within an environment of name games enacted in tandem with forms of erasure and rewriting. Existing literature has moved forward from the autobiographies published by the artist through the flower My Struggle as a Woman Artist in 1975, which was followed by a second memoir, Beyond the Flower, the Autobiography of a Feminist Artist, in 1996. These retrospectively positioned the artist's work of the 1960s within the context of a highly personal struggle and defined domes and lifesavers as abstract imagery related to the female body. The strongly autobiographical content of Judy Chicago's work and writings after 1970 has encouraged researchers to approach analysis of her pre-1970s artistic production, likewise from a biographical perspective. Most significantly, Gail Levin's 2007 biography, Becoming Judy Chicago, expanded on this trend in a highly detailed account of the artist's life from birth until approximately 2006. I seek here to examine the artwork and writings of Judy Gerowitz when she was working alongside her Los Angeles-based Finnish fetish colleagues in comparison to the redefinitions published by Judy Chicago. And ultimately, I will problematize a seemingly unified artistic feminist narrative by recalling not only what was erased, but also interrogating what was added in its absence. Furthermore, for historical precision, I will refer to the artist as Judy Cohen, her birth name, when speaking of her pre-1961 work, as Judy Gerowitz when unpacking her work and writings from 1961 to 1970, and as Judy Chicago when discussing her work and writings composed after October 1970. While many of the artists' Los Angeles-based colleagues engaged with name games and self-styled public personas throughout the 1960s, in Chicago's case, it was the constructed identity that became the dominant personality, erasing and rewriting the history of her earlier self's artistic production. As Judy Cohen, the artist composed brushy, figurative works such as the portrait of Jerry Gerowitz seen in the background of this photograph. Cohen grew up in Chicago, Illinois. Had been living in Los Angeles since 1957 while attending UCLA, aside from a year-long stint in New York from 59 to 60. As such, she was familiar with Hollywood constructs and public personas. She changed her name to Gerowitz in August 1961, shortly after marrying Jerry Gerowitz in June of that year. In her second memoir, published in 1996, the artist stated that the principal motivating factor behind the changed nomenclature was the desire to have a recognizable professional name. She wrote, quote, "When Jerry and I were wed, I had kept my original surname, altering it only after noticing while doing the gallery stroll every Saturday afternoon, which is what all the cool art people did, that there seemed to be too many other artists named Cohen." Concurrent with the change in nomenclature, her work dramatically shifted from brushy and gestural portraits to hard-edge geometric abstraction. Gerowitz's paintings, such as Untitled and Untitled of 61-62, are semi-symmetrical and non-objective. The acrylic on canvas paintings consist of a principal circular form within which trapezoidal shapes occupy the central area. The work was formally and conceptually influenced by Billy L. Bengston. Bengston, at the time a rising celebrity within the LA art scene, was hand-painting compositions such as Gregory from 61 on the left. Gregory is a large lacquer and synthetic enamel painting on a square composition board. Pale yellow sergeant stripes hover at its center and are surrounded by concentric circles of brown, yellow, white, and blue. Gerowitz's paintings, like Bengston's, are composed of circular forms on a square platform, and both artists use cool and warm colors to create a sense of depth and the illusion that the central forms were floating. Cohen and Bengston had first met during the summer of 1961 on a Saturday afternoon gallery stroll down La Cienega Boulevard, which is what all the cool art people did. Bengston was distinctively performative in his self-styled and self-conscious presentation, and it is notable that this meeting shortly preceded both the name change from Cohen to Gerowitz, as well as the artist's formal shift to a geometric hard-edge painting style. However, in Judy Chicago's 1975 autobiography focusing on the time period of 1961, the artist neither discusses her work nor her increasing awareness of the cool art people. Instead, readers are presented with a highly personal account of the strained marital dynamics between her and Jerry Gerowitz. Much of this discussion pivots around household chores, which were a central concern of the emerging feminist discourse of the 1970s. She recounts a narrative from 1961 that reads, "One day, Jerry left his socks on the floor, something he had done more than once. I exploded. What makes you think that because, by a biological accident, I was born with a cunt, I am supposed to pick up your socks?" In October 1964, Gerowitz exhibited Car Hood in a group exhibition at Rolf Nelson Gallery. The work was painted using an automotive spray gun and featured precisely in brightly delineated geometric forms on the surfaces of an actual 1964 Chevrolet Corvair car hood. Hanging vertically, the undulating and immaculate surface of the three-dimensional object protruded from the wall and warped the reflections of viewers within its highly polished and reflective surface. Following Jerry Garowitz's death in 1962, Judy Garowitz had begun to spend an increasing amount of time at Barney's Beanery and in the company of artists including, but not limited to, Bingston, Kaufman, Bell, Good, and others. Just as these artists were exploring aspects of identity performance and the construction of pseudonyms and alter egos, so too did Garowitz begin to perform an altered version of herself. By her own account, she began to pose as, quote, one of the boys by wearing boots and smoking cigars. Steeped in an art world exploring aspects of rebranding, Garowitz began to similarly investigate this conceptual enterprise. In late 1963, Garowitz visited Bingston's studio for the first time. In a recent interview from last summer, she said, Belial gave me one of the most important pieces of advice I ever received. Don't pay attention to reviews, he said. Just count the number of pictures and the column inches. Mostly, Belial provided me with a model for what a real artist should be. Plus, I went to the motorcycle races to see him ride and hung out with him at Barney's Beanery. In the passage, the artist credits Bingston for focusing her attention on aspects of publicity and character and characteristics requisite of an artist in Los Angeles. Bingston, in turn, remembers Garowitz as performative in her self-presentation. He described her as, quote, she wasn't just in the art scene, she was an art scene. Immediately prior to constructing Car Hood, Garowitz had spent an intense 3 weeks in New York with John Chamberlain and attended an 8-week summer auto body class in Los Angeles. Chamberlain, at the time, was constructing sculptures such as Miss Remember Ford of 1964. Ford was shaped out of the cut, crushed, and discarded fragments of metal gathered from automobiles and subsequently painted with an automotive spray gun, a technique that Chamberlain had learned from Bingston in the summer of 63. In a 1964 letter, Garowitz described how Chamberlain had gotten into a scene with police and spent the night in jail. She wrote, the cops were rather disconcerted by the hundreds of people who flocked to jail to get him out. When asked for his name, he kept insisting he was Jackson Pollock. Chamberlain was not only working with the material elements of the automobile, but was also playing celebrity name games by posing as someone else. Upon returning to Los Angeles in July 1964, Garowitz began to casually go by the name Judy Chicago and enrolled in a summer auto body class. Los Angeles gallery director Rolf Nelson had begun to refer to the artist as Judy Chicago, a name suggested by Garowitz's Chicago accent, in late 1963 or early 1964. Thus, while in auto body school in the summer of 64, a class in which she was the only female out of 250 students, she purposely adopted the name as an alternative nomenclature. Her descriptions of the auto body class in various contemporaneous letters are replete with allusions to the odd and incongruent situations that resulted from the gender ratio. She wrote that it was, quote, a pretty funny scene, the school, that gave me my own private bathroom. I was the only chick. There were a lot of hassles and bad scenes, but I learned a lot. The first day I was there, nobody swore. It was awful. I really had to watch my tongue. Much like Garowitz's Car Hood, Bingston's exhibited paintings beginning in 1962, such as Buster, were painted using an automotive spray gun and similarly featured concentric circles and a central geometric form. Yet, while the lines of Bingston's compositions fluctuated between hard edge and hazy, the lines of Garowitz's Car Hood were precise and crisp. Bingston had not only established a particular paradigm for an artist in Los Angeles, but had also helped Garowitz achieve the smooth and uninterrupted surface of her sprayed work. In the late summer of 64, he advised her to soak herself and her working environment in water and to use Vaseline to slick back her hair. This would prevent lint and dust and other particles from adhering to the surface of the sprayed works. While Bingston refers to feminism as horse shit and to Garowitz as an artist who invaded his turf when she began to spray, he also concedes that she very successfully negotiated branding and publicity strategies to establish herself as a successful artist in profile-conscious Los Angeles. Writing retrospectively about Car Hood in her 1975 autobiography, however, Judy Chicago,
positioned the work as an overt and conscious juxtaposition of male and female sexual symbolism, writing, quote, "The vaginal form penetrated by a phallic arrow was mounted on a masculine hood of a car." While Judy Garowitz's car hood may have responded to the central aspects of car culture in Los Angeles, it also participated in the push to pristine and reflective surfaces constructed in conjunction with performed public identities. The hanging sculpture's geometric forms, automobile and sprayed medium, and the artist's hyper-masculine performance and casual adoption of the guise of Judy Chicago situate it as also closely related to the work and strategies of those artists with whom she was engaging. In 1965, Garowitz began to produce playthings with rearrangeable pieces, such as aluminum rearrangeable game board on the top and multicolor rearrangeable game board on the bottom, and the later untitled participation sculpture of 1967 on the right. The playing boards of both game boards are highly polished and mirror-like. The blocks of aluminum are also quite reflective, while the painted pieces of multicolor are a bit less so. Participation sculpture is comprised of 24 gold-plated steel pieces, 12 identical cubes, and 12 identical cylinders, originally titled Untitled Participation Sculpture in 2007 at the artist's request. The work was renamed Cubes and Cylinders. These objects are participatory, and the artist's instructions accompanying each piece encourage one to rearrange and manipulate the game pieces. And when played with, scuff marks and fingerprints are left on the highly polished material that comprises each composition. Garowitz's playthings were constructed immediately after Robert Morris's exhibition in New York's Green Gallery that opened in December 1964. And a photograph of the show was reproduced in black and white in Barbara Rose's Looking at American Sculpture, published in the February 1965 issue of Art Forum. Although Garowitz did not see the show, she did read the article. Within Morris's exhibition, seven sculptures constructed from 2x4s and gray-painted plywood were arranged throughout the gallery. The geometric forms were stripped of extraneous elements and void of surface inflection. They delineated the space in which they were located, and in so doing, obliged patrons to navigate around the objects while also calling attention to the physical and temporal relationship of the viewer to the space. While Morris's installation had compelled patrons to move in a particular manner within the exhibition space, Garowitz's games scaled to the photographic reproduction of the exhibition rather than the exhibition itself, reverse the relationship between object and patron. In her constructions, patrons moved and controlled the blocks instead of the constructions directing the movement of patrons. In a publicity photograph on the right, Garowitz is shown placing the blocks on one another. There is a sense of precariousness to the arrangement, and the size of her in proportion to the blocks is emphasized, as is the manipulation of the blocks themselves. The reversal was played out on the game board and suggested that within exhibitions of emerging minimalist work, people were manipulated much like the play blocks that composed the games. Furthermore, the hands-off nature that had informed understanding of Finnish fetish was also reversed in the games. The pieces were meant to be handled, touched, scuffed. In 1965, Garowitz wrote, "I'm finished with the kind of surface and craft preoccupation of the boys. It's a dead end that leads to preciousness, and they're really fucked up by it." And in a recent interview, the artist acknowledged that the game boards were related to the trend toward a formally minimal aesthetic, writing, quote, "I saw exhibitions and was in an art world environment that influenced me toward a minimal format." The games adopted the look of large, contemporaneous, and geometric works. However, they rescaled the size, reoriented, and rearranged the agency so that the artist or patron controlled the objects instead of the objects dictating the movement of the patron. However, writing in 1975 as Judy Chicago, the games were resituated as small pieces that paralleled her personal experience as a woman in a male-dominated art world. Chicago wrote, quote, When I made small, rearrangeable pieces, I was trying to give my voice to my own feelings of moving through and out into an unfamiliar world, trying to gain control over my life, end quote. The small, rearrangeable compositions engaging with a minimalist aesthetic were redefined as a metaphor for how the artist gained control of her life in relation to the men with whom she interacted. In late 1965, Gerowitz began to list her name in the phone book as Judy Chicago. And shortly thereafter, her first solo exhibition opened at Rolf Nelson in January 66. You can see photographs here. In a recent interview, the artist stated, quote, "By the end of 1965, I was listing my name that way as Judy Chicago in the phone book as a sort of art world joke. I knew that other artists were doing that. If you knew what their underground names were, you could find them. Otherwise, you were out of luck," end quote. While the nomenclature had first emerged as an uncertain nickname, by the end of 1965, it had begun to exist as a published pseudonym. Listing her contact information under the alternative namesake, an ongoing joke within the insular group of Los Angeles artists, evinces the degree to which she was engaged with the strategies and shenanigans of her colleagues. Yet, despite listing her name as Judy Chicago in the phone book, she continued to exhibit and produce work under the name Judy Gerowitz. Simultaneously, her exhibited works expanded and enlarged the game boards into large sculptural works that rearranged the view of attending patrons. The 1966 exhibition included, among other large pieces, Rainbow Picket on the left and Sunset Squares on the right. The armature of each large piece was constructed from plywood and subsequently wrapped in canvas and spray painted. The colors were matte, each unit maintained a uniform color, and the individual units of each sculpture were placed directly on the floor. Within the exhibition, and especially the well-attended opening, viewers and the artist intermingled and became part of the installation. As one circumambulated the objects, the shapes and colors were rearranged so that each piece varied drastically according to angle of view, as can be seen in the reinstallation of Rainbow Picket at the Brooklyn Museum in 2014. As both perceived and perceiving bodies, one experienced the installation as a constantly shifting and segmented space. Viewers who saw others through the negative spaces of the sculptures did not see their entire body, but rather saw a body that was segmented, partially erased, sliced, and divided by the sculptural forms placed throughout the space. While Morris's Green Gallery exhibit had consisted of mostly singular objects painted white and placed on the floor, against the wall, or well above the viewer's head, Gerowitz's interacted directly with the viewing body, erasing and revealing sections over time. The pieces readjusted the site within which bodies arrived whole, became segmented when seen through the objects, and then were made whole again. From April 28 through June 1, 1969, Gerowitz exhibited 30 sets of domes at the Pasadena Art Museum. Originally, Gerowitz's exhibition included her series of lifesavers, such as yellow on the left and red on the right. But the large spray paintings were removed from the exhibition at the last minute by curator John Copeland's. These works, however, would be shown months later at the Cal State exhibition under the name Judy Chicago. The domes were comprised of clusters of three hemispheres that ranged in color from opalescent whites to bronze to multicolor hemispheres. The acrylic domes were made of vacuum-formed plastic and spray-painted on the reverse side. The lifesavers were circular graphs comprised of hollow circles mapped against a grid and spray-painted onto acrylic boards. Accompanying the exhibition was a handwritten folded catalog that resembled an instruction manual or a diagram. Within the single leaf catalog were sections labeled notes on color, notes on technique, and a self-referential notes on catalog. Each gridded unit contained Gerowitz's long hand script explaining the color system she followed when spraying the domes and the lifesavers, as well as the techniques and materials used in their construction: spray gun, airbrush, automotive wax, etc. The catalog reproduced the schematic diagrams and charts that outlined both the color sequence and the prescribed color placement within each dome and each lifesaver. This was accompanied by a brief discussion regarding domes, she wrote. Color and diagram below goes across surface, blending and changing gradually. In all domes, color appearing on top actually exists in different layers inside the dome, etc. And regarding the lifesavers, she wrote, the paintings are diagrams of the color systems used in the sculpture. The catalog thoroughly mapped out the system and materials of the domes and lifesavers so that others could realize the pieces. Reviews of the exhibition were generally positive. One review focused on the artist's investigation of color systems, while another addressed how the pieces engaged with emerging conceptual art trends that had expanded over the last 2 years. Specifically, in the summer 1967 issue of Art Forum, Solowit had published paragraphs on conceptual art, which argued that, quote, in conceptual art, the idea or concept is the most important aspect of work. Decisions are made beforehand, and the execution is a perfunctory affair. The idea becomes a machine that makes the art. Building on an increased artistic investigation of systems, Judy Gerowitz's domes and lifesavers used a Los Angeles visual rhetoric to methodically approach color. Yet, in the artist's retrospective autobiography from 1975, domes were resituated as pieces that explored personal subject matter. She wrote, quote, as I was still trying to slip by in the male art world and express myself without losing validation from men, I decided to use three dome shapes, the simplest forms that I could think of that had reference to my own body, breasts, fecundity, while maintaining the necessary neutrality of the art world. And lifesavers were redefined as an expression of the artist's sexuality and identity. It is notable the contemporary understanding of domes and lifesavers distinctly contrasts to the initial systematic investigation of color. The pieces have been rebranded as a step within the artist's progress toward a feminist artistic practice. Initially, they were reframed within the 1970 Cal State exhibition alongside a catalog and a series of infamous persona-defining art form ads. The first ad on the left, narrating the name change, was published prior to the opening of the exhibition. While the second ad on the right, although posing as an exhibition announcement, was in fact published after the show had closed. The second ad visualized the artist's constructed persona in boxing trunks and a sweatshirt emblazoned with the name Judy Chicago. Photographed by Los Angeles-based Jerry McMillan from a low angle, Judy Chicago gazes down at the viewer while the boxing gloves and tightly laced boots loomed larger than life due to their proximity to the camera. Behind Chicago is Alona Hamilton Cook posing in the role of corner woman and modeling a Team Chicago t-shirt. Outside the fighting ring, but with one leg straddling the lower rope, was Jack Glynn, the artist dealer, posing as her manager and dressed in a sport coat and large checkered bow tie. While the first ad constituted an erasure or a crossing out of Judy Gerowitz, the second ad established the constructed and public personality of Judy Chicago. Much like Bingston's motorcycle ad had promoted neither the artist's artwork nor an exhibition of it, Judy Chicago's ad engaged in a similar strategy of persona publicity. The composition displayed the degree to which the artist was ensconced in an environment steeped in self-styled publicity antics that characterized the branding strategies of her LA cohorts. The qualities that had characterized her peers' engagement with both Los Angeles Finnish fetish and identity play were siphoned by Chicago as a tool for establishing an artistic practice intimately tied to her artistic identity and constructed biography. And just as Bingston had published an artificial but authorized biography to accompany his 1968 retrospective, so too did Chicago publish a highly tailored autobiography in 1975. Like her colleagues, she used depictions and narrative constructs of herself to tweak public associations of her work. And the content of her early work was, as a continuation of this practice, erased and rebranded in 1970 and re-narrated in the 1975 autobiography, so as to operate in the service of the construction of a public identity and a feminist artistic practice, thus tapping the strategies of her colleagues as a means of moving away from them. Thank you.